Hello, I'm Dr. Timothy Johnson, the retired medical editor for ABC News, and I welcome you to this Monday, December 2nd edition of The Truth About Obamacare. Obviously, a lot to talk about with our regular panelists. Dr. Gail Walensky of Project Hope joins us from Washington. Dr. John McDonough from the Harvard School of Public Health joins us from New York. And Dr. Larry Levitt from the Kaiser Family Foundation joins us from their offices. And I'm going to begin with you, Larry, because obviously we have to talk about the website. We're hearing so much today about the website. The general consensus seems to be that the front end is now working better. That is, people can get on, do some shopping, try to sign up for something, but that the back end is still a mess, meaning they can't really be sure that their insurance company is getting the information and that they, in fact, have a policy. Is that accurate? And will the back end get fixed?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mean, the administration set the end of November as a deadline for getting the site working more smoothly for most people. And that's true. People who weren't able to create accounts or buy a plan are able to do so now. They've also added an anonymous shopping feature so people can browse or window shop for plans without actually setting up an account, which makes that a much easier process. So it's all working much better on the front end. The back end is still a big concern. I mean, this is basically the transmission of enrollment information from healthcare.gov to insurers. The step after that is people would have to pay their premiums and then be enrolled in a plan. So if that's not working and people think they have insurance that they actually don't have, that could end up being a big problem come January.
Has the government talked about a deadline for that fix?
There really hasn't been talk of a specific deadline. I mean, I think they realize that it's got to be done it's got to be done soon, in fact, for people to really finish the enrollment process. But they've not been specific about exactly what's wrong or how it's going to be fixed.
And obviously, we will follow that story. But we're going to leave the website for the moment and proceed to what I think is a really fundamental question, maybe the fundamental question. And I'm going to pose it in the words of Paul Krugman, who obviously writes from the left, but I think in posing the question is right in the middle. He says, "It goes without saying that the rollout of Obamacare was an epic disaster. But what kind of disaster was it? Was it a failure of management, messing up the initial implementation of a fundamentally sound policy, or was it a demonstration that the Affordable Care Act is inherently unworkable?" Gail, you are a longtime Republican advisor. You think a lot about these matters. You've had great experience in government, head of Medicare, Medicaid under the first President Bush. Is this simply a failure of management, or is it inherently unworkable?
It's definitely a failure of management and a complete embarrassment to the administration. It is way too early to know what kind of unintended consequences may result from the policies. I have some questions about some of the specifics about the policies that are in the Affordable Care Act, but not about the general objective of trying to expand insurance coverage to 30 million uninsured, and even the general idea of using Medicaid expansions for the lowest income and subsidizing the purchase of private insurance for people who are not as low income. All of the specifics about how else that happens, there are a lot of questions. Not the only way to do it, but an okay way to do it.
What are your major objections to the current plan as is?
There are several levels of objections. One of my concerns is that people who are in similar income positions are going to be eligible to receive very different kinds of subsidies depending on whether they have employer-sponsored insurance or whether or not they are either getting Medicaid right under the cutoff or subsidies in the private exchanges. That is fundamentally a bad recipe for an unstable environment where people get substantially different levels of subsidies depending on whether they get their insurance from their employer or they get their insurance some other way, because their employer either isn't or wasn't providing insurance coverage.
And at a practical level, help me understand why that is so bad. People comparing notes or what happens?
No, it will induce people to change their positions if being in a different position will mean substantially different subsidy levels. So it is destabilizing from where we are. You can debate how much somebody at 200% of the poverty line or 135% of the poverty line should receive in terms of purchasing insurance, but it shouldn't differ substantially depending on whether they get it via employer-sponsored insurance or through the exchanges or because they're on Medicaid. Now people who have employer-sponsored insurance have very little subsidy. It's not the employer that's providing compensation in terms of the premium. That's just the employee's compensation package. The subsidy that they get is not having to pay income tax, which many of them don't pay anyway, and not having to pay Social Security tax on the employer contribution. That is not a very big subsidy, certainly not a very big subsidy compared to those who are being subsidized directly.
So let me,
let
me just jump in a minute and turn to Dr. John McDonough, professor at the Harvard School of Public Health, longtime Democratic advisor. What do you think?
Well, I would agree with Gail that it's not a great outcome, a great situation to have people treated differently. That is the nature and structure of the American health insurance system for years and years, as long as we've been in this. I think on a theoretical level, we would like to even this out, but it runs then slam into one of the principles that people tried to incorporate in designing Obamacare that was done significantly and not perfectly, and that is that if you like the coverage you have, you can keep it. And giving people the ability to keep the coverage that they like or even that they're not so wild about necessarily creates these kinds of inequities in terms of one person paying one thing at different levels. It's not just income, it's also age. You know, people who are in their 60s will pay premiums at the same income level as three times as much as someone in their 20s. And so there are inequities built into it. It has never been the primary objective of health reform to try to eliminate all of these. I think we do significantly reduce them and create greater equity, but it is far from perfect equity.
And I'll come back to you, and Gail, and say, how does this inequity you describe and worry about differ from the instability we have in our current system, which is all over the map?
Well, let me first say that it's not an individual's choice about whether they accept the employer-sponsored insurance or whether they get their insurance in the exchange. It would be far better if that were the case. People are not eligible who have employer-sponsored insurance, and it is likely to lead to having employers be persuaded to drop coverage if most of their employees would be better off. It'll be much harder if there's a mix of employees and some would be better off and some would be worse off. Then they would have to change employers in order to do anything about this. It is a problem that has existed before and that people who didn't have employer-sponsored insurance had no subsidy. That was definitely inequitable. Many policy people on the left and the right have talked about the unfairness of that. It's why refundable tax credits were proposed either completely for those, for everyone, or for at least those without employer-sponsored insurance. It will destabilize more than is necessary. It is something that is likely to be forced to be addressed if, in fact, individuals attempt to try to move to where they can get a better position, which really now means getting your employer to drop your insurance coverage if you're a real middle-income person.
So, Larry, let me jump to you surveying this scene because, you know, this is one of the charges from the right, from Republicans in general, that a lot of people are going to be worse off because of Obamacare, because of the kinds of issues that Gail is now describing. How do you address this from the standpoint of a numbers cruncher, and I know you're far more than...
I didn't say worse off. I said that people are going to be treated very differently given the same income because of where they get their insurance. That's an invitation to destabilizing a market.
Okay, and in plain English, when you say destabilize a market, I mean that sounds like a disaster.
Well, what it means is getting employers who have mostly employees who would benefit from being in the exchanges to drop their coverage, pay the penalty, and go in the exchanges, which might be regarded as a matter of indifference, except if it costs more because the subsidy is greater, it means a higher price for the taxpayer.
Okay, now we're getting down to what we hear so often as a charge, which is that employers will, in fact, drop coverage and ask their employees to go to the exchanges. Larry, does the polling or does the kind of sensitivity you have to public issues indicate this is likely to happen in large numbers?
Well, I think it's very unlikely to happen. In other words, for employers to drop insurance that they're now providing early on. I think it's very unlikely to happen in year one or even in the first few years. And frankly, I think it's even more unlikely now, given all the rocky rollout. I think it gives employers some hesitation in dropping coverage over the long term. Where there are particularly smaller employers with lower wage employees. As Gail said, it can be a win-win. I mean, the employer can provide more compensation to the workers. The workers can actually get bigger subsidies if they are lower income in the exchanges. And I think some of those employers may drop. But as Gail said, I think it's important that those are not that sounds bad, but those workers are not necessarily losers in that situation.
But Gail, just back to you for a minute. He describes it as a win-win, but you're saying it's a loser for the taxpayer.
Yes, it's a win-win for the employer and the employee. It means more money being spent in the subsidies, and that means that taxpayers are going to have to put a larger bill than they would have otherwise.
John, you agree with that?
Well, essentially, but remember, they're in inequities. The health insurance deduction that we have right now in the tax code is completely regressive. The higher your income, the larger the benefit that you get in terms of a lower cost of health insurance. And to some extent, what's going on is kind of creating greater equity between folks at higher income and lower income. And some of that will lead to some of these kinds of shifts and adjustments. For example, Walgreens and Trader Joe's are two companies that dropped providing coverage for their part-time workers. I would argue that those workers are going to be significantly better off.
Dr. John McDonough, professor at the Harvard School of Public Health, longtime Democratic advisor, what do you think?
Getting coverage through the exchange that they otherwise got through part-time coverage with their employers. So there's all kinds of distributional effects. And, a lot of them are potentially going to cost more to the federal treasury, but people are going to be much better off.
So this sounds to me like what some politician... We're picking up a little announcement in the Amtrak station where Gail is coming from. But what John just talked about sounds like what many politicians on the right are referring to as redistribution of wealth. Is that what we're really talking about here, Gail?
Who do you think is paying for much of the coverage expansion? Clearly, the higher income are by increasing the Medicare tax and expanding the Medicare tax to unearned income for individuals who are above $250,000. That was one of the sources. There will be redistribution, although less clear about how it moves across income classes, when the excise taxes on pharmaceuticals and health insurance and medical devices are passed through to current holders of insurance. It's a redistribution from the currently insured to the currently uninsured and a general redistribution from higher income individuals to middle and lower income individuals. No doubt about that.
And John, I assume you would say that's a good thing.
I would add to that, by the way, it's also a redistribution among states. If all states, for example, were embracing the Medicaid expansion, the ACA would represent a massive shift in wealth from higher income northern states to the southern states with the huge numbers of uninsured. But now because a lot of those states are now refusing to embrace the Medicaid expansion. Actually, there's going to be a shift in the distribution of wealth from the ACA, from those conservative states up to the northern states, which are embracing the Medicaid expansion. So, you know, the distributional effects go in literally thousands of different directions, and it can be a great parlor game drawing a map of who are the winners and losers. I think the important piece, though, is whether or not we as a society are better off because of these kinds of reforms and changes. And in that way, while clearly there are pluses and minuses on both sides, as we've just discussed, I think overwhelmingly the answer is that this is a net positive for the American society as a whole.
I'm going to save the Medicaid expansion question for our next session because it's fascinating why Republican governors are turning down the federal money and whether that'll come back to haunt them. But I want to come back to the question that Krugman posed at the beginning and offer his answer and ask Larry if he agrees. So he says the answer lies in the California experience. He says California is an especially useful test case. First of all, it's huge. If a system can work for 38 million people, it can work for America as a whole. It's hard to argue that California has had any special advantages other than a government that actually wants to help the uninsured. California, however, came into health care reform with 22% of its non-elderly population uninsured, compared with a national average of 18%. And he said the early results from California are very encouraging. The young are signing up. Is California, the state where you live, Larry, an example of how Obamacare might work nationally eventually?
Well, I do, you know, and it's honestly not just California. It's the state of Washington. It's frankly Kentucky. I mean, a number of states that were aggressive in implementing the law have succeeded so far, at least for the management challenge part of it. California did have something of a head start in that they'd been we in the state had been debating health care reform under Governor Schwarzenegger before, and in fact, the ultimate Affordable Care Act looks very similar to what California tried to enact. So I guess I would still separate, though, the management part of it, which a number of states have succeeded at, where the federal government has not, from whether ultimately the law really does work or whether there are unintended consequences, as Gail said. And I think it's way too early to conclude that it's working or that the unintended consequences are acceptable. It'll be months, if not years, before we know that.
Yes, Gail.
We can't say that it's working in California. What we can say is that the exchanges appear to be reasonably functional in California. That in no way, I mean, it's required first step in order to have anything else happen and shouldn't be regarded as a great accomplishment other than what's gone on elsewhere. We'll know that Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act is working when we see most of the uninsured actually enrolled in programs and able to get care in a reasonable manner from either physicians that are nearby or from ambulatory care centers or from health care centers of some sort. It's a pretty darn low bar if the metric of saying Obamacare works is if they can actually get through the free exchange.
And John, I'm going to give you the last word. 1 minute. Massachusetts is successful. Does that tell us anything about Obamacare?
Well, it disproves the null hypothesis that it can't work. I think that, I think Massachusetts provides an example that it is possible, but people can point to many important differences. I guess the thing that I would emphasize is it's important for people to be aware of just how important January 1st is. January 1st represents a fundamental turning point in terms of how our health system has operated forever. On January 1st, insurance companies can no longer discriminate against people based upon their medical condition. The subsidies for the exchanges, the actual enrollment and coverage under Medicaid, the individual mandate, all of these things take effect. This is going to be transformational for the system and really represents the fundamental important building block of implementation of this law. And I think once we get past January 1st, there's no turning back. And I think that's basically going to put us in a much stronger and better position as a society.
But doesn't the back end have to work for all that to happen?
That goes without saying.
Okay. We'll be back together in 2 weeks on December 16th. We'll have more information by then. And obviously, sometime in January, we'll see if John's predictions about turning a corner are coming true. Thank you all for joining us.